What's cracking, folks? I'm Jared Dubin, and this is Quo Vadimus. We are recording this episode on Monday morning to talk about the game between the two best teams in the NBA from Saturday night. We're talking Warriors-Spurs with Seth Partnow, the editor of Nylon Calculus. Seth, what's up, man?
How you doing? I thought we were going to talk about the Northern Iowa collapse. No? Okay.
I actually did not even see the actual collapse because when it was a 12-point game with 30 seconds left, I flipped to whatever the last game on was. I can't remember. Oregon, maybe?
Yeah.
And I flipped with, like, you know, 45 seconds left or something. I was like, okay, game's over. Then Oregon got to halftime, and all of a sudden I see people on Twitter talking about how Texas A&M came all the way back. I was like, what is going on right now?
Yeah, it was a confluence of unlikely events, definitely.
It was, as Sam Seaborn would say, an Aristotelian confluence of events that could only happen to me.
And it's our weekly Sorkin.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the podcast is called Quo Vadimus, so.
There you go.
Let's talk Warriors Spurs though. I want to start from the beginning of the game, where three starters or de facto starters, I would say, were out of the game. With Tim Duncan did not start for the third time in his NBA career, wound up playing only 8 minutes all game. Then for the Warriors, Andrew Bogut and Andre Iguodala, Bogut obviously a starter and Iguodala, their sixth man, did not play either. Very interesting move from Pop, obviously, not starting Duncan. It was a pretty big conversation on Twitter after the game, which of those quote-unquote absences meant the most. And it's a strange conversation to me because two of them were absences, and one of them was Pop making a decision to not play Duncan, basically.
You know, I'm not sure I agree with that totally. I think it's sort of half strategic, half rest, you know?
I didn't mean making a decision necessarily because it gave them a better chance to win, which is the way that people were framing it. I thought that Brian Giberman made a good point before the game when he said that he thought the reason that Duncan didn't start was because Pop didn't want the Warriors to see what their small ball lineup looked like against a Duncan Aldridge front court. And those two guys didn't play together. Duncan only played 8 minutes. None of them, I believe, with Aldridge. So they did not see what that lineup looks like against the real, you know, the two best two big guy lineup that the Spurs can throw out there.
Sure. I think the biggest absence from the game, just from a style standpoint, was probably Iguodala. Mostly just giving Golden State that kind of second ball handler creator on the floor, which they possibly could have used with kind of the amount of switching that San Antonio was doing, just having one more guy who could you know, attack the feet of whether it was Aldridge or DL off the bounce, instead of basically Steph having to be the one to do it all the time.
That definitely makes sense. And that obviously was, I think, I don't know if it was necessarily the biggest reason that Steph was, you know, quote-unquote shut down, but obviously it was one of the big contributing factors. It was interesting, I thought, after the game that he said that he should have just driven to the basket more. You know, typically he does try to shake big guys up and get free for a jumper, which, you know, more often than not goes in. The few times that he did drive, he drove on LaMarcus two or three times and got layups, but he missed a couple of those as well. I mean, I'm not necessarily sure he should have, like, just driven more. Like, stuff just wasn't going in that usually does.
Yes, to some degree. He was also taking some, you know, again, it's, he, I think we've talked before about how his shot selection is among the most difficult thing in the league to evaluate, just because the line between, you know, what is a good or not a good shot or not for him is almost impossible to draw. If they're going in, they look like, you know, Steph being silly, but that's a makeable shot for him. If they're not, then it's like, maybe that was a little too aggressive for him. And, you know, on a night where they weren't going in, it did seem like he was, you know, being a little trigger happy, over aggressive. But again, that's reacting so much to whether the shot ended up going in or not.
Yeah, so, definitely. What about the actual strategy of switching? Did that surprise you? That's not usually how teams go about it. Although, you know, teams do switch more on Steph simply because they just don't trust their guy to get over the top of the screen in time to take away the option of shooting a three. But, you know, we've talked a bunch about the best way to defend that Steph Draymond high pick and roll. Plenty of people have defended it. I don't think anybody has come up with, you know, switching a true big guy onto it is the best way to do it. You know, some teams have guarded Draymond with a three, like Oklahoma City put Durant on him so that if they had to switch, he would be the one on Steph instead of, say, Ibaka or Adams. But I don't know if teams have been comfortable just saying, okay, work on our big guy.
I think it was kind of a conscious decision that it's almost like, you know, end of the game, up three situation, where, all right, just we're switching everything, no threes, and do that the whole game. And if, you know, Steph and Clay are going to drive by us 40 times and score, then that's how they're going to beat us. I think there's probably some merit to that. I think, you know, you can... they're going to have some success, but can they do it enough and efficiently enough and do it without turning the ball over and do it without getting tired? I think that's forcing them to kind of go into traffic over and over again might kind of have a cumulative sort of effect over the game. So in that way, I think it makes some sense. You know, committing to the making them do something else to beat us strategy, with the caveat that again, you know, Steph they you know, Clay and Steph did shoot 23s between them, so you know the how effective they were running them off the line is maybe again we're reacting to missed shots more than we are to you know, defensive greatness, even though qualitatively, they did seem like harder shots than the Warriors got in the first meeting between the teams.
So I think the big question then is, do you think that it's replicable in any way by anyone else? Like, that's the thing that matters here, right?
The hard part is you know, with especially with Duncan not playing that much, I'm not sure that many teams have bigs as, you know, laterally mobile as Aldridge and Diaw. Diaw especially is kind of, despite his roly-poly physique, has got good, very good feet in space. And so I think that just from a personnel standpoint, I think that it's going to be a hard defense for other teams to replicate. And also teams that maybe, you know, you play smaller bigs there and try to do it. That takes away the other half of why the Spurs defense was better, which was their ability to kind of take the pace out of the game on offense. And Aldridge and Diaw with their post-up ability and their offensive rebounding ability really helped to slow the game down. This is one of the... you know, this was the slowest game the Warriors have played, regulation game that they've played. I think that it's probably fair to separate out overtime games just because there's kind of more of those hold the ball, run the clock down possessions in an overtime game. This is their slowest regular season game by a decent margin. And from a Spurs standpoint, they were they played far slower than they did in the first meeting between the teams offensively. And I think that, you know, being able to intelligently use Aldridge and Diaw, you know, with size advantages, I think helped the San Antonio's defense, because it allowed them to kind of be set up to pick Steph up early. I would say in transition, but there really wasn't any transition. So I think that was something I've been harping on against Golden State all year is, you know, if you finish your offensive possessions well, whether or not the ball goes in, that's the first step to really getting to grips with Golden State's offense.
Well, that was, you know, exactly what Cleveland did in the first three games of the finals last year. I remember writing about it at the time. You know, run the clock down on offense with long possessions. Avoid turnovers by going with, you know, ISO post-ups. Hit the offensive glass hard, which San Antonio also did, and did extremely well. And also a little bit of pressure in the backcourt. Like, the Spurs, a bunch of times, had Danny Green in the backcourt on Steph to make him take a couple seconds off the shot clock, bringing the ball up the floor, and then would switch Patty Mills onto him once he got into the front court, so that he wasn't going against the same guy that just chased him around up the floor for 4 or 5 seconds. All of those things, I thought, contributed to slowing the game down.
Yeah, and to do that, to have that kind of jam the outlet in the backcourt, you kind of need to be able to find him first, and having the possession end in your offensive possession end in sort of a controlled way allows for that better than if you're turning the ball over, if you're jacking up quick shots, where, you know, just finding Curry would make it difficult to even apply that sort of token pressure in the backcourt. So again, I think that was really the biggest difference between the two games, I thought, was the control that San Antonio played with on offense.
Now, I guess, you know, the question there again is, how replicable is that? Because, you know, so much of the Warriors' defense involves forcing turnovers, and I would imagine they're significantly better at that with Bogut and Iguodala especially available.
Well, the funny thing is I mean, they did. I mean, they had. I have to look again, but I think the Warriors had like 12 steals. The Spurs had 17, 18 turnovers. I mean, it's not like San Antonio wasn't completely pristine in their ball handling. I think Ginobili especially was pretty loose with the ball. It was more so than the turnovers, it was they avoided those situations where, you know, Golden State gets a bucket, you come back, jack a quick shot, they run out, get another bucket, happens again, timeout because of a, you know, an 8-0 run in 30 seconds. They completely avoided any tendency to fire right back at Golden State. And some of the, you know, there were times where San Antonio even, I remember several occasions where Danny Green just passed up, you know, a what would be a normal catch and shoot look for him to say, you know what, this is early, slow it down, recycle the offense. May not get that good a look again, but it's more important to not kind of ping pong the ball right back to the Warriors. And I don't know if that was a strategic thing or just, you know, that happened to be the decision Danny Green was making, but that was noticeable. There was just so few times where they attempted to score quickly after a Golden State score.
Yeah, that's something that I noted actually during the game, was Danny Green passing up a couple, at least, transition threes, because usually he takes those. And I said, like, if Danny Green was still Danny Green, he takes that transition three. But I guess it does make sense if you frame it in that way, where it was a deliberate attempt to just not take quick shots at all.
Because I think you've seen this all year, where Golden State, where they just go on those quick runs, is when the game gets just frantic for, you know, that 1 minute stretch. And you know, and this is the other thing, you know, the two things that I really felt like year against them have been not getting frantic on your own offense. And if it starts to happen, take a timeout early. We've all seen NBA games where you kind of know when the timeout to stop the run is coming. And against Golden State, take that timeout one possession early. When that first time you get you take a quick shot and they run out on you instead of letting it build for an extra possession or two. And interestingly, by the way, Mike Bowie of InPredict did an interesting piece over the weekend, noting that Popovich has long been the coach with kind of the quickest trigger finger on those kind of timeouts based on time of the game. So I thought that I didn't notice it specifically in this game, but that's something he's probably very willing to do, is to take that early timeout to stop a run at 4-0 instead of waiting for it to become 9-0.
I wonder if one of the nerds can figure out how true that is.
I would look on InPredictable.com. Did a post this weekend.
With the actual data.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought it was just a theory on. Okay.
No, this is actual nerds. Did actual nerd stuff. That's what we do.
Okay. All right. Well, that's very interesting, and it's also, another way to contrast him with, the other guy considered one of the best coaches of that era was Phil Jackson, who basically always let his teams play through the opposing team's runs.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that to some degree, that's a reflection of the teams they had, in that his Chicago teams, especially, I think more so than his Laker teams, probably were well equipped to play in a more, at least for that era, a more kind of flowing, discombobulated game than their opponents were. I don't think that there's been any team that's better suited to play in that style maybe since the Showtime Lakers, than this Warriors team. So it's just the comparative advantage is as much a work here as kind of coaching philosophies.
I agree with that. I did also want to talk about at a certain point in the game when Golden State saw how the Spurs were defending those Steph Draymond pick and rolls, they started using Barnes as the screener a few times. We've talked about before how they're extremely willing to just use somebody else if they don't get the right matchup they want with Draymond. The Barnes version, obviously, was not quite as successful as the Draymond version, but I'm not sure it was necessarily because it was Barnes as the screener. They just, they couldn't punish switches no matter who was switching. For some reason.
Yeah, I think that's right. And some of that again is Curry just not hitting shots and a little bit of kind of the talent drain of not having Bogut, not having Azeli, not having Iguodala, not being able to have kind of the variety of options off of that their team at full strength has. I think that speaking of Bogut and Azeli, I think that having that club in the bag is one of the ways that in a playoff series they might counteract kind of that front court pressure a little bit. It's not going to take too many Bogut blind screens at half court to loosen that guy up a little bit. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Picking up. Sorry?
I'm saying absolutely. I agree with you.
Yeah, and they don't have anyone on the roster right now who can kind of, set that kind of, that solid back screen. Varejao's probably the closest on the roster, but he can't play at all.
Yeah, so. And his stretch in this game was an absolute disaster. They got outscored by 12 points in the 6 minutes he was on the court. early in the second quarter. I mean, I understand the desire to get a big body out there a little bit, but at a certain point, you just got to admit failure on this thing, and you can't throw this guy out there against anybody that's good. He can't move. He can't rebound. He doesn't keep the ball moving like he used to. Look, I love Varejao, the player, when he was good, but this is not that guy, and he's not the closest thing they have to Bogut on their roster. Like, that's just not actually true. And I thought even McAdoo did a nice job when they threw him out there instead.
Yeah, he had a nice little stretch where kind of his athleticism allowed him to make some nice plays.
Yeah, I mean, he even made like a nice pass to the corner, sort of behind him, out of pick and roll that you would normally see like Draymond make, and not a lot of big guys usually are able to make. Like if the corner guy is in front of them, and it's, you know, easier for them to see, a lot of guys can make that pass. McAdoo wheeled around and threw it to a guy sort of behind him because he was deep in the paint and the guy in the corner was halfway up towards the wing. I can't remember who it was, but it was a very nice pass. It was surprising to see him make that. And, you know, that's a pass Draymond can make and Bogut can make. And right now, Varejao can't make. And when Azili comes back, you would hope that the Warriors recognize that Varejao just can't be out there anymore.
Yeah, you know, Spates is probably a better option.
Especially now anyway. That he's shooting threes.
Yeah. Other things I saw from this game, I thought his stat line wasn't great. I thought Tony Parker was actually reasonably effective. He competed defensively. He's never going to be a lockdown defender, obviously, but I think that, again, we talked about kind of the Spurs' offensive kind of flow, and he was able to at least, you know, not break the defense down, but at least bend it to allow kind of, you know, that's the problem the Spurs had massively in the first game, was not even getting that first bit of penetration to force the Warriors' defense to react at all and kind of allow San Antonio to get into that, you know, that cycle where they create a small advantage and the next player kind of keeps that advantage and picks that a little bit and on until they finally get, you know, a dunk or an open three or something like that. And, you know, they weren't massively effective this game, but it was more so. You know, they only scored 87 points, but they only played 86 possessions, so that's not... quick math shows that that's an offensive rating over 100, and you know it's not awful. It's not great, but you know they can certainly shoot a little better at times. So, but especially with Parker on the floor, that was noticeable how much smoother their offense was, and especially in the same game compared to how it looked with, you know, Ginobili and Mills on the floor where. They just weren't getting that. This is not Manu's best game.
No,
I'll say he hit some threes, but aside from that, it was like I said earlier, he was loose with the ball and kind of not able to really get them into any sort of rhythm at times.
Yeah, I thought that the stretch that they had Mills, Manu, and Anderson out there together at one point was San Antonio's worst stretch of the game, probably. I thought when they played Parker and Mills together briefly, that worked out well. The two of them combined were only 3 for 13 for the game. But like you said, they sort of controlled the flow. Parker, I think, offensively, and then Mills in terms of when he was out there, really staying inside Steph's dribble right until the point when he switched, which is... You know, a lot of teams will switch, but not stay all the way up before that to make the actual process of getting the switch difficult. They'll just say, okay, we're not going to let him take the three, so we're going to switch this. And it's not taxing enough to get the switch. And I thought that that played a fairly important part also.
Sure. And I think the last point on the Spurs offense I want to make for now is the first game, they tried to post off a ton both games. The first game, it was very much kind of the Mark Jackson special, dribble the ball down a side, whether it was Aldridge or Leonard or Diaw, kind of gets to that side of the floor, kind of tries to post up, sticks a hand up, gets pushed out to 12 feet, and we play, 1997-style basketball. They did that sometimes this game, but it was much more, especially when Aldridge was being effective. He was kind of posting up on the move, catching the ball 2 feet in the paint, and really allowing his size to shoulder dip, quick dribble the other way, power up through Draymond. That's much more effective than, catching the ball at 14 feet and trying to, dislodge, a guy with a lower center of gravity like Draymond. So, I think that, again, that them just getting that little bit extra flow and movement of their offense allowed them to even post up more efficiently. And, Aldridge wasn't massively efficient this game, but it was certainly a better overall look getting him the ball than it was, the first game when they had, he shot poorly, didn't take many shots, and they turned the ball over trying to get it to him, whereas it just, was much cleaner this time out.
I think it helped also that they didn't just start forcing it to Aldridge in the post right away. They started off the game going to Diaw in the post a bunch, then Diaw came out and they started going to Kawhi in the post a bunch, and they worked their way through a little bit before getting into a bunch of Aldridge post-ups. They got him a few spot-up jumpers. They had him especially really crashing the glass very hard, and he was a big part of them winning that battle on the boards. I think he wound up with 3 or 4 offensive rebounds. Kawhi had 5 or 6 offensive rebounds. But Aldridge also, not even just getting those offensive rebounds, but making defensive rebounds much more difficult than they typically are against the Spurs, who normally don't try for offensive boards. And he stayed in there very consistently trying to battle for the offensive rebound, which also, I think, helped slow down the game a little bit.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's not something you typically see the Spurs do. So I thought that was interesting as well, because any deviation from typical strategy sort of gives a clue about how the coaches might view the potential playoff matchup. And Pop is not usually one to give anything away beforehand. So to have such a noticeable deviation in the regular season was, I think, fairly unusual.
Yeah, I still kind of feel like this game was both teams not, like, once the game started, all the players on the floor were obviously, playoff intensity is a cliche, but I think this was that for the players on the floor at all times. And certainly, you saw Steve Kerr was fired up, got a technical very early in the game. But I think that both teams kind of still held a fair amount back, mm-hmm. just from a strategic standpoint. We did see Danny Green guarding Steph a lot, and he did so very well. Especially, I thought he was good when Steph had the ball, but he was really good, kind of maintaining body contact off the ball and kind of trailing him around screens and communicating when the switch. I think they did a really good job of, when Curry was off the ball, Green didn't switch unless it was like kind of a guard to guard pick when he and Mills would switch or something like that. Yeah. Instead of allowing Curry to get switched off onto a big off the ball, which I think would actually be much more dangerous, because a guy like Aldridge or Diaw isn't used to chasing a guy who's hunting catch and shoot jumpers the way that Steph would.
Right, and so two things on that was to go connected to that point. If you switch off the ball with a big guy, then all of a sudden that big guy is now going to wind up guarding the ball handler in a dribble handoff or a pick and roll that's coming up soon, which, you know, two times in the game they wound up getting that, and Steph scored on both of them, but they didn't really let him do it for most of the rest of the game. And both times it was the first possession coming out of a timeout. But both times it was actually after a timeout where the Spurs had the ball first, and then the Warriors came down and ran basically the exact same. It was like a double pin down with the dribble handoff as on the third screen on the opposite side of the court. And it was just too difficult for one guy to chase him all the way around. So they wound up switching basically twice, and Steph wound up being able to get to the rim both times. But other than that, they didn't really let that off-ball switch to a big guy happen very often, if at all. And then, you know, in terms of holding back strategically, this is something we mentioned after the first game. I still think that Pop's eventual strategy in this series is going to have a lot of Kawhi on Draymond. And I don't think we saw very much of that in this game either.
I don't think we did either. So what do we think this game means? I thought the first game, I think it means sort of the same thing that the first game meant, is that, if one of these teams doesn't play well, they lose against each other.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think the Warriors played as bad this game as the Spurs, as badly as the Spurs did in the first meeting, and that I think is you know, people are making a big deal of, well, when the Spurs played bad, they lost by 30, and the Warriors played bad, they lost by 8. The Warriors didn't play nearly as badly today as or Saturday as the Spurs did in that first meeting. Because I don't think many teams have played as badly.
No.
As the Spurs played in that first meeting. So, you know, I still think that you have to say that Golden State is still a decent favorite in this series. But from an unpredictability standpoint, you at least know, all right, San Antonio can do this if things break a little bit right for them.
Yeah, I would say very much like the first game where we came on that podcast and said, you know, what we learned is that if the Spurs don't have Tim Duncan and play like crap, they're going to get smoked. I think we learned in this one that if the Warriors don't have Bogut and Iguodala and play like crap, they're going to lose. You know, I don't think that the Spurs solved the Warriors. I don't think that, you know, it necessarily means all that much that, oh, the Spurs only won by 8 when the Warriors didn't have Bogut and Iguodala and they played like crap. I think that, you know, the Spurs found a few things that might be able to work, and the Warriors found a few things that they need to work on. I don't think it tells us necessarily in the big picture, oh, this is how you solve the Warriors, or anything like that. I mean,
it does. I mean, there are some things that you know, if you can do this, that will help. That's a pretty big if, you know, because I think that you know, everyone all season, well, if you slow them down, well, that's kind of easier said than done, and the Spurs did a very good job of that, you know, on Saturday. And very few teams, if any, have really, I mean, nobody's really has done it as effectively this season. So, you know, if you need to do that to beat them, good luck. But again, it's the execution of the thing, you know, you need to execute, which is, you know, a hallmark of kind of Spursy basketball, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I mean, the finding things that can work is different from solving them, which, you know, every time the Warriors have lost, people love to jump out there and be like, oh, see, they're overrated, they lost, because if Steph doesn't make his shots, then you can beat them. And like, yeah, no shit, if the best player on the team doesn't play like he normally does, every team is more vulnerable. Like, is there any team for which that's not true? Like, if Kawhi comes out and gets burned on defense 4 or 5 times and doesn't make his shots, then it's a lot easier to beat the Spurs, too. Like, if LeBron comes out and goes 1 for 16, it's a lot easier to beat the Cavs. Like, I don't understand the people that love to come out there and talk about how vulnerable the Warriors are if Steph doesn't play his best as some sort of proof that they're not good.
Yeah. In some ways, the March Madness is a great palate cleanser, because it's kind of the interminable takes portion of the NBA season where, you know, it's all kind of set, and we're just kind of waiting for the playoffs. So people are just kind of recycling the same arguments at an increasingly, you know, deafening volume. And instead, we can, you know, watch 20-year-olds not know how to break a press, and that's at least different.
Right. One thing I thought was an interesting move the Warriors made a couple times to deal with the fact that the Spurs were switching all of the Steph Draymond pick and rolls was that they went, you know, opposite to Draymond Steph pick and rolls, which obviously became pick and pops. And he wound up wide open 2 times on those, and he actually missed both of them. But, you know, I said after they ran the first one, he wound up with a wide open shot. It was, you know, if you want to watch the play, it was with, you know, 4:30 left in the first quarter. If the Spurs keep switching like that, I think we're going to see a little bit more of that in playoff series than we did in this game.
Kind of using Steph as a screener and putting Tony Parker or Patty Mills in an unfamiliar spot of having to being the help defender on a pick and roll.
Right.
Yeah. No, I noticed that too, especially Parker just kind of was like, what do I do? and kind of, well, on one occasion, I think Green got down the lane and got fouled. I think one time they did that. I don't remember if it was a Green Curry pick and roll, but it was definitely Green using Parker's man as a screener.
Oh, yeah, and look, it's an incredibly difficult situation for a guard to be in to begin with, just because it's an unusual thing for them to have to deal with, because, you know, again, usually they're guarding the ball handler and not the screener. But it's even more difficult when the guy with the ball is basically a guard in a big man's body, who is able to attack the rim and run the pick and roll, you know, like a point guard would, just because of his passing skills as well. And then the guy setting the screen is the best shooter in NBA history. And you literally, I mean, if you leave him, it should be death. Like, you know, the 2 shots they wound up with, like, I would say 60 to 70% of the time they're going to go in the basket. They just happen to
that's
not...
That's a little high.
I mean, so. Steph shooting a wide open three with nobody within 4 or 5 feet of him, how often does that go in?
He's probably, on those shots this season, he's probably in the low 50s.
All right, so more often than not, it's going to go in.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe I overestimated a little bit, but
yeah,
it certainly feels like it goes in 100% of the time.
Well, of course it feels like that, because you only remember the ones that go in.
Well, I remember the 2 that didn't go in this game.
Well, there you go. So you remember those 2 that didn't go in, and the rest of them you remember are the ones that went in.
Right.
But, yeah.
Was there anything else that you thought was particularly notable?
Martin played in the fourth quarter of this game.
Yeah, that's not something I expect we'll see in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Yeah, David West got in the second half instead of Duncan. I still think that he's not necessarily going to be someone that sees a whole lot of time in a potential Warriors-Spurs playoff series. I think he gets played off the floor defensively.
If Azili and Bogut are available, I think he'll have a role. Especially, I think Azili has the potential to really kind of wreck San Antonio on the defensive board. So having you know, having mean guys like David West who are going to fight him, it might be kind of a necessary matchup. But I think West is probably much more situational than regular rotation, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So I do want to go back to Duncan, though, because, you know, I would say this was part strategical. That's a word, right?
It is now.
Part strategical and...
Or strategic. Just strategic.
Strategic and part rest. What do you think the balance was there? Because, I mean, I can't imagine we get into a Warriors-Spurs playoff series and Tim Duncan's playing 8 minutes a night. I can't see that actually happening.
Me neither. I think it kind of, you know, coming off the bench was weird for him, and he got in and never really got into any sort of a flow of the game and the way the game was going. You know, Aldridge had it working a little bit on the block at that point, and instead of, you know, at a certain point, it's like, all right, this is working okay. Take the rest of the night. I think that was as much to do with it as anything. Now, whether they go back to starting him, even if the Warriors start small in a playoff series, that's an interesting question. Because I do agree with you that the constant switching thing does not work as well, and kind of who you put Duncan on, who is he guarding? At this point, maybe just have him guard Barnes and dare Barnes to do anything. This was not a good Harry Barnes game.
No.
As he continues his role of as kind of sin eater for the entire Warriors fan base, they focus all of their ire on him. But I don't know. It's a good question. I think that, you know, it being Tim Duncan, he's going to be fine until proven otherwise, I guess, is how I'm going to view it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And just quickly on Barnes, I thought that Nate Duncan made a good point. He just doesn't seem to have the same sort of quick explosion that he normally does still, coming off of the injury that he had early in the season. I don't think that he's really looked at, not necessarily as fast, but as like, there's not as much quick power coming out. And if he gets like a bigger guy on him, he's not as quick going by. And if he gets a smaller guy on him, he's not able to rise as quickly in the post, which is something that they can usually punish. Not necessarily with, you know, Barnes scoring from a post up, but the fact that if he can create an advantage there, that then, you know, obviously the defense has to react to that. And I thought in the second half, especially of this game, that when they went to him in the post or Clay in the post, the advantages weren't created and they wound up just taking post-up jumpers, which is, I mean, the Spurs will live with that all night.
Yeah, actually I thought Livingston was also very guilty of just, you know, tossing up a bunch of, like, turnaround fadeaways.
Yep, that's especially, I thought, early on in the fourth quarter, the three of them were out there together. And, I mean, it looked like Mark Jackson-style offense. When, you know, three or four possessions in a row, Clay was posted up, and he took a few jumpers, and then finally he hit Varejao across the court, who made, like, the best pass that he's made since he's been on the Warriors. To Barnes, who wound up with a jumper. But the few times that they were posting up before that, they were getting these looks that weren't actually good looks, but seemed like they were because it was Clay shooting over a smaller guy. And of course, Mark, during that time, is like, oh, they got to keep hitting this matchup for Clay Thompson in the post against a smaller guy. And I'm sitting there thinking they're just not getting the quality looks that they typically get at all. And that's why Mark Jackson...
It's magic. It's magic. He had his back to the basket. The shot has a 50% higher chance of going in because it started with the guy's back at the basket. That's how it works.
Right. Well, that's, you know, why Mark Jackson is announcing the game and Steve Kerr is coaching it, you know? which I believe I've said multiple times about the two of them in games that Mark announces, because for some reason we have to have the former coach of the Warriors announcing Warriors games. That actually reminds me, the best part of the game was Mark Jackson saying something. Jeff Van Gundy and him were talking about how a few years ago Mark Jackson said that Steph and Clay were the best shooting backcourt of all time, and people gave him some pushback. And Van Gundy was trying to give him credit for saying that, and Mark Jackson was like, I would love to take credit for them being the best shooting backcourt of all time, but something else. And I was like, I've never believed anything more than Mark Jackson wanting to take credit for that.
What you said.
Right. Anyway, is there anything else from this game, or is that all for you?
You know, I think after a very full 4 days of basketball, I think that's all. Anything else we need to hit on? Something I've been noting recently, just to get away from that completely, is that the Toronto Raptors are one game back of the struggling Cleveland Cavaliers, and have the season tiebreak with them. So that's potentially very interesting in terms of the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, I mean, we keep waiting for some other version of the Cavs that blows everybody out of the water to show up, and it has just not happened yet. Obviously, we'll see eventually if it does, but right now, it ain't happening.
Yeah, no, I guess David Blatt wasn't the problem. Who knew?
Right. I mean, who would have thought that letting the best player on the team also be the GM and pick his coach wouldn't necessarily solve everybody's problems.
Allegedly.
Right. Oh, of course. I forgot about the fact that they put out there right after that LeBron had nothing to do with it.
Right.
Yeah. Who knows? Anyway, there are no Thursday night TNT games this week, so we'll see if there will be another podcast later on in the week. Who knows? Next week, there are two games on the early side. They start at 7 o'clock. It's Bulls-Rockets and Clippers-Thunder, which I think should be mildly interesting, at least.
Well, it's a battle for even getting into the playoffs, the first game.
Yes, and the second game, you know, potentially a battle if the Clippers start playing better over the next week or so, you know, could have some impact on the 3 seed in the West. The Clippers are, I think, four games back or so now. But Blake could be back by that time, so.
He still have the suspension, though, won't he?
Oh, right. I mean, I guess if he comes back this week, then he could have missed the 4 games by then.
Sure.
Right. Anyway, you can find Seth on Twitter at Seth Partnow. You can find me at JADubin5. Find all the Hardwood Paroxysm Basketball Network podcasts on hardwoodparoxysm.com by clicking on the link at the top of the page for the podcast center, or on iTunes, Stitcher, or Blog Talk Radio. Seth, good times, man. We'll do this again soon.
All right, talk.